I'm Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. On today's show, I'll speak with music historian and author Tim English. Tim is the author of John Lennon 1980 Playlist, a book that takes a look at iconic musical influences in John Lennon's life that led to what Tim says was John's most productive year. We'll talk about who some of those musicians are and what Tim learned while researching this bit of music history.
For the other half of the sky. Woman, I can hardly express.
Here's my conversation with Tim English. Welcome to Lifestyles.
Thanks for having me on, Lillian.
Your recent book is John Lennon 1980 Playlist. John was killed in 1980. He would have turned 80 this year. He stopped recording and releasing music in the mid-1970s, but you write that in that 1980 was his most productive and creative year since the 1970s. How so?
Well, when he got to 1980, he was kind of taking a look around the musical landscape, and he was listening to what was on the charts at that time. He hears Queen's song, Crazy Little Thing Called Love, that in March, I guess it was the number one hit in the U.S., and he hears them doing Elvis Presley in that song. It's kind of a un-Queen-like song. It's sort of a rockabilly number. And John hears them doing Elvis in that, and he hears that and says, hey, maybe it's my time again. Maybe it's my time to come back.
What spurred John to return to the studio? You talk about Double Fantasy was released. A couple of weeks after Double Fantasy was released, he went back into the studio. And you also talk that 1980 was his big year. Obviously, it's the year he was killed. But I guess beforehand, he was getting back into it?
Well, it was really his year of creative rebirth. His songwriting process had been kind of stagnant. By the time he got to the mid-70s, I think he was kind of burnt out, and he probably needed some time off. And that coincided with the birth of his son, Sean, in October 1975, and also with the lapsing of his contract with Capitol Apple in the beginning of 1976. So both of those together kind of convinced him, you know, to stay home and take some time off. But in 1980, he said the music of 1980 is the best period for music that has been since the 1960s.
Huh.
And I mentioned the Queen song later that spring. By two different accounts, he hears Paul McCartney's Coming Up on the radio and really gets turned on by it and maybe gets the competitive juices flowing again, because, of course, that was sort of the engine room of the Beatles, was the songwriting friendly competition between John and Paul. But by both accounts, the people who were in the car with him when he heard the song, he was really taken with that. And when he gets to Bermuda in June, he all of a sudden, he's got the boomboxes out, he's recording songs again, demos for what would become Double Fantasy and Milk and Honey. And one of the first songs he records is a song called I Don't Want to Face It, which came out on Milk and Honey in 1984. And if you listen to that song, the music sounds not dissimilar to Coming Up, the Paul McCartney song that maybe got him interested in recording again, but also the lyrics, too. They both have the lines, you say you're doing this, or you say you want to do that. Some people think it might even be a response to Coming Up. At the same time he's in Bermuda, he's in a disco in Hamilton, and he hears the B-52 song, Rock Lobster, very cool, unusual song at that time. And he hears them doing Yoko Ono, and sure enough, Kate Pearson and the rest of the B-52s were one of a relatively small handful of people that bought Yoko Ono's albums when, with the Plastic Ono Band and on solo earlier in the, you know, probably a decade earlier. And John hears them doing Yoko in that song, and that's exactly what they were. They had been influenced by her. And he says to himself, wow, the world is finally catching up with what John and Yoko were doing 10 years earlier. It's time to get back in the studio. And as soon as he got back from Bermuda in late July, he's in the studio first week of August recording Double Fantasy.
Wow. You also mentioned that the Doobie Brothers had an influence there as well.
Well, you know, there are a lot of Beatlemaniacs out there, Lillian, who think they know everything. This is one of the things in the book that I don't think has been brought out before. John had a copy of the Doobie Brothers' 1978 album, Minute by Minute.
Mm.
That is the album that contained the huge hit, What a Fool Believes. It has another song on there, though, called Don't Stop to Watch the Wheels. And, of course, John had been writing a prototype for what became his famous song, Watching the Wheels, on Double Fantasy, earlier in maybe 77, 78, called Emotional Wreck, but he did not finish the song. And somewhere between 78 and 1980, the song gets retitled Watching the Wheels. Both the Doobie Brothers songs and John's song have the line, Watching the Wheels Go Round, in it. I speculate, but I think it's probably true that John copped that title from the Doobie Brothers song, because it's certainly not a phrase that you hear very often. By the way, John was also a big fan of somebody who was associated with Michael McDonald, Christopher Cross. He loved Christopher Cross's music. Christopher Cross was huge in 1980. People may recall with the song Ride Like the Wind and the number one hit Sailing. John loved Christopher Cross's song Sailing, which was on number one when he was recording Double Fantasy.
My guest is music historian and author Tim English. His newest book is John Lennon 1980 Playlist. Now, you mentioned Christopher Cross. You also mentioned a few other artists. You talk about Bruce Springsteen, Christopher Cross, and the Rolling Stones as other artists that were on the charts at that time. What did he think of them?
Well, 1980 is really an interesting year because it's disco had kind of petered out maybe the year before. New Wave is in an ascendancy, but that's going to peter out pretty soon. And a lot of artists of John's era that came up in the 60s were still on the charts in 1980, but for a lot of them, it was kind of a last hurrah.
Right.
Even Paul McCartney coming up was his last solo number one hit in the United States. He had a couple with Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder subsequently. But the 1980s was kind of a rough time for a lot of those contemporaries of John's. That said, the Stones album Emotional Rescue came out in the summer of 1980, and that was number one album while John was recording Double Fantasy. In one of his interviews, John spoke very highly of the song Emotional Rescue, called it a beautiful track, and said, you know, Mick Jagger doesn't really get the credit he deserves. On the other hand, a photographer, Ethan Russell, was with John a couple weeks before he died. They were filming what was going to be a video in Central Park for the song John had selected to be the second single off Double Fantasy, Woman, which was released posthumously. But the guys doing the video wanted John to lip-sync the song Woman, and John didn't want to do that. And they said, why? He said, well, I don't want to be like Mick Jagger, 40 years old, prancing around in front of the camera like some some fool in a video. But he did speak of the Springsteen song Hungry Heart in his last interview. He compared it to his song Starting Over, saying they're both sort of 50s-type songs with a modern veneer on them. That he said likewise about the Cars song Touch and Go in that interview, too, which is a great song, kind of underrated. John was a fan of the River album by Bruce, which was the big album that fall. He heard it, and he came out, and he told one of his aides, he said, well, his is better, meaning his album is better than Double Fantasy. And in one
wow.
of his last interviews, he said, you know, I might actually get off the couch and go see this guy one of these days. I've heard he's very good in concert. Bruce and the E Street Band actually played Madison Square Garden that Thanksgiving weekend, a couple of shows. So John, I guess he missed the opportunity to go and see him then. I do quote in the book, though, an old Beatle hand was doing PR work for Springsteen in 1978, a guy named Tony Bramwell. And he said he tried to arrange a meeting of Bruce and John, but it never happened. John was lying low at that time and just didn't want the attendant publicity that would have come with it.
What did you learn when researching for your book about John and what he thought of other genres of music?
I don't think you could name a genre, Lillian, that I don't have in this book. The only one I could think of is opera, maybe. he loved all different types of music, reggae. He was a big fan of Bob Marley. In fact, the Bob Marley song Hallelujah Time was actually written by, not by Bob Marley, but by a woman named Jean Watt, who was married to Bunny Livingston of the Wailers, but that has a line about borrowed time in it, and John was inspired to complete his own song, Living on Borrowed Time, by that Bob Marley and the Wailers song. So he loved reggae. He loved the two-tone ska that was coming out of England in 1979 and 80, groups like Madness and The Selector. He liked Alina Lovitch, who was a popular new wave artist at that time. He actually went to see the new wave band Devo in 1977 at a club in New York. Huh. I tell the story of Mark Mothersbaugh in the book, said that he couldn't believe there was a drunken John Lennon singing his song back to him. Stuck his head in the car window after the show and was singing the song Uncontrollable Urge, the Devo song. This is even before Devo had a record contract. But John listened to ambient music. There was an album by Wendy Carlos called Sonic Seasonings he was a big fan of. And there are actually quite a few ambient sounds on Double Fantasy if you listen to it. For instance, the end of Starting Over, they have an airport, the flight announcement at the end of that song. He loved jazz. Jamaican-American artist named Monty Alexander. He was a fan of his. He loved Jermaine Jackson's song, Let's Get Serious. It was kind of a very funky song that was a hit in the spring of 1980. Basically a Stevie Wonder song and everything but name only. Stevie produced it, wrote it, sings on it. And I said he liked easy listening, too. He liked Olivia Newton-John's song, Magic. He was a big fan of disco. He he loved Donna Summer. He mentioned Donna Summer repeatedly in his interviews. He had her song Hot Stuff on his jukebox. And actually, his one number one hit that he had back in 1974, the only number one song he had in the U.S. while he was alive, Whatever Gets You Through the Night, is actually based on a disco song called Rock Your Baby, a 1974 hit for George McRae. And if you listen to the two songs, kind of the guitar groove in each, you can sort of see where John
was coming from there.
Molded Whatever Gets You Through the Night from that song.
My guest is music historian and author Tim English. Tim, where did he fall on either country music or, I don't know, funk or punk?
Well, we, as you said, with funk, and that song by Jermaine Jackson is pretty funky. He liked the punk music. He kept up on what the Sex Pistols and Sid Vicious and The Clash were doing. He said The Clash were good. He liked the energy of that music. Talk about surprises, though. I was surprised he really had a soft spot for country, too. He asked his aide to get him Dolly Parton's cover of the Jerry Lee Lewis song, Great Balls of Fire, in 1979, and that was sort of a surprise that he was following country music that closely, that he'd be aware of that song. He also, it's kind of a strange story, but Dolly Parton had a song called Starting Over Again, which was actually written by Donna Summer, but that was a number one country song in, I believe, May or so of 1980. And John changed the title of, instead of calling his first single from Double Fantasy Starting Over, he changed it to Just Like Starting Over so people wouldn't confuse it with the Dolly Parton song. It was not a big pop hit, but it was a major country hit. But yeah, John was always a big fan of country. He used to sing Hank Williams around the house when he was a little kid. Of course, the Beatles had... John got into music with Skiffle. Skiffle was his first band. The Quarrymen were a Skiffle band as opposed to rock and roll. And Skiffle was basically kind of an amalgam of country and blues. So, yeah, he was a fan of that music, too. He also once asked Waylon Jennings to do a cover of his Mind Game song called Tight As. And there are not many underrated John Lennon songs, but that's one where people who are not familiar with it might want to check it out. But he wrote to Waylon Jennings, I believe it was early 1975, saying, hey, I never put this song out as a single, but I made a mistake. I probably should have. He said, why don't you try doing it? I thought it was probably pretty cool that here's one of the most famous entertainers in the world, one of the most, you know, renowned songwriters of the 20th century, yet he's pitching his material still to another artist, which I thought was kind of funny and kind of cool, I guess. I don't think Waylon ever recorded Tight As, though.
So you can hear your passion about music and about the historic anecdotes that come with it. Why was it important to you to write this book?
Well, John was always a hero of mine, I have to say. I was in college when he was murdered, and, you know, in a way it's a little bit embarrassing, but it was just a devastating experience, I think, for everybody who was around on that awful night. But his memory and his music go on. If you listen to his interviews from 1980, they're always asking, when are the Beatles going to get back together? Well, right. Like, you could recreate that. And John and the rest of them were smart enough to know, you know, you can only stick your hand in the river one time. You couldn't recreate. The Beatles were very much of their time. Everything they did sort of took place in that actual calendar decade of the 1960s. It's really fascinating. They didn't do hardly anything before that, and they didn't do hardly anything after that, at least as a unit.
Right.
But I guess I would try to write a book, Lillian, that I'd want to read myself. And I found this was a way of really examining John's life during the last years, and by in illuminating aspects of his personality and of his story via the music that he was listening to. And as we discussed earlier, some of these songs actually impacted crucial decisions that he made during 1980. We talked about the ones that were important in compelling him back into the recording studio after 5 or 6 years. He was back in the studio a couple weeks after Double Fantasy, as you mentioned earlier, and I could never figure that out. Why? Why would you go back to the studio? We just released an album.
Exactly, yeah.
But I tell the story in the book, which I don't think a lot of people are aware of. He found out that one of the hip discos in New York at the time, called the Peppermint Lounge, was playing Yoko's Double Fantasy track, Kiss, 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 in the disco, and he thought this was a really hip club, and John said, wow, isn't that great? She's finally getting the recognition she deserves. We need to put a record out, especially for these discos, like a dance record with her on it, and we're going to get her a number one record. And that's what he was doing the last week of his life. He was in the studio overdubbing a track called Walking on Thin Ice that they had recorded back during the summer, and he put on some really cool, really adventurous, inventive guitar work on that. If you listen to that track, you know, he was just so enthusiastic that Yoko was finally going to get some recognition. I actually corresponded with someone who was in the studio with him at that time and saying how just turned on he was by all that. You know, of course, that song is a little bit eerie in retrospect, the title of it, and that's what John was listening to the last weekend of his life, Walking on Thin Ice.
After a quick break, Tim talks about his background as a music historian. Stay with us, because at the end of the show, I'm going to ask for your help. I hope you'll participate. You're listening to Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. My guest is music historian and author Tim English. Tim, what's your background in music and music history? Why is this a passion of yours?
Just love music. This is my third book, and I always try to, as I said, write a book that I'd be interested in. I did a book that was fairly notable a while back called Sounds Like Teen Spirit. That book was about pop and rock songs that appear to have borrowed, quote-unquote, their melodies from earlier songs, and there's tons of information on the Beatles in that book. For instance, where the riff from I Feel Fine came from, where the beginning of Revolution came from. That book was really fun to write because it gives people a lot of aha moments where they've heard two songs a million times, they never realized one copied another. I'll give you another example, the Bachman Turner Overdrive song, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. The guitar in that is based on a riff from the Who song, Baba O'Reilly. I had heard both of those songs a million times, but until I discovered that, I never knew that one had influenced the other. As admitted by Randy Bachman of Bachman Turner Overdrive, by the way. But anyway, that's just one example. So that's probably what I'm best known for, is that book, Sounds Like Teen Spirit. And if you're into rock and roll, I think people would dig that book, too.
Now, I was a Beatles fan, mostly of their early years. Can you talk about those early years or late years and the relationship John had with the other three Beatles?
Yeah, well, one of the things I try to do in the book is both connect what was going on in 1980 to John's earlier work. I also try to connect it to what was going on that year, and then sort of how that year echoes even in our present day. It was a year of a lot of change. It was kind of the sunsetting on some ways of the 1960s and a period where people thought you could really change the world with music. By 1980, that idea was sort of dying out. On the other hand, a lot of the things that people fought for in the 60s were becoming more accepted, part of the culture, civil rights, women's rights, environmental concerns, all those type of issues were gaining more and more of a foothold as the time went by. As far as his relationship with the other guys in the band, I think it was very close. the one time John stepped in the studio between when he was finishing up his rock and roll album in early 1975 and when he recorded Double Fantasy in the summer of 1980 was in the spring of 1976, where he flew out to L.A. to record a track for Ringo's album, which became Ringo's rotogravure, called Cooking, a John song that he helped Ringo record just out of friendship and loyalty to his bandmate. And that was the only time he set foot in the studio in all those years was for Ringo. He had written a couple of songs that he had gifted to Ringo, possibly Nobody Told Me Was Gonna Be One, and also a song called Life Begins at 40, neither one of which Ringo ever recorded, as far as I know. So he was always looking out for him, trying to help him. By a couple of different accounts, people said he loved those guys, you know. They were like brothers, especially with Paul. They bickered a lot in the press, I think.
Right.
But Robert Hilburn of the L.A. Times, in his interview in October, asked him about, again, back to the song Coming Up. He said, were you surprised it was so good? And John said something very touching. He said, no, how can you be surprised by your brother? And his last car ride, the people that had interviewed him the afternoon of December 8th from RKO, they were taking him to the studio that night. And they started asking him about his relationship with the other Beatles and specifically with Paul. And he said, well, you know, families fight a lot, you know, and we're like a family. We fight sometimes, but deep down we really love each other. He said, I'd do anything for him, and I know he'd do anything for me, too. I think underneath it all, there was a lot of love there.
I believe that to be true, and I know that it's kind of unfair to the two living Beatles. They get asked that so often, and I'm sure they get tired of answering it. But I think both Ringo and Paul got together and did something as a tribute to John. And, of course, we've lost George as well.
He recorded Grow Old With Me not long ago, which is just a beautiful song that John wrote in Bermuda in 1980. It came out on the Milk and Honey album in home demo form, but he never got to, as I document in the book, he had big plans for that song. He thought maybe strings and bagpipes and other stuff on that song, but his demo, his piano demo, is just beautiful, and there's some other versions you can find online of acoustic versions, but just a beautiful song. And, you know, people always say, oh, John was the rocker, Paul was the soft guy. That's much too simplistic. John wrote some beautiful, touching songs, such as Beautiful Boy and Good Night off of the White Album. I think when you study him a little bit, there was a soft, that he had had a lot of hurt in his life, losing people close to him as early in his life, and he developed kind of a rough, mean, sometimes sarcastic exterior to kind of protective shell type of thing.
Who did you say re-recorded? Did you say Ringo and Paul recorded Grow Old With Me?
Yes, yeah, I think the Ringo's last album, I think it came out this year.
Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be. When our time has come, we will be as one.
And what do you know of he and George? George was considered the nice one. I don't know. I think they're all pretty cool.
It's amazing that how chemistry works with people. I remember reading years ago, a guy who worked at Apple in London, which was a crazy place and crazy time and crazy atmosphere. And if one of them was around in the office, there'd be a big buzz and everybody's so excited, and two of them a little more so. But there was something about it when the four of them were together. There was some sort of energy, some sort of spark, and it's just that X factor with people, maybe even with couples. You try to be a matchmaker or put people together and say, well, you know, they're both Dodger fans or they're both like skiing, and that's absolutely nothing to do with anything else. There's some sort of X factor. People can have nothing in common, and yet they bounce off each other and inspire each other, and there was something special about that. George and John were very tight. You know, the Beatles, a lot of their fighting was over business issues and boring stuff that nobody likes to hear about. And John was piqued at George because he put a book out I think it was in 79 or 80, basically a book of his lyrics with stories in it. And John was not happy because he barely mentioned John in the book. And John said he mentions every two-bit session man he never ever played with, but he never talks about the guy who was responsible for getting him in the Beatles.
Oh.
You know, so it was, I think underneath it all, they had great feelings for each other. But, you know, they could be a little testy, and John was testy about both Paul and George in his interviews in 1980.
Go figure, they were human, right? Human nature does certain things.
Well, people forget that a lot of times, and John, it's amazing when you think about it, but as Jack Douglas said, when John gave him those Bermuda demos, he had the utmost secrecy, almost like a Mission Impossible thing. He put him on a seaplane or from Manhattan out to the mansion on Long Island and gave him the tapes. For your eyes only, don't mention this. If you mention it to anybody, the whole thing is off. And why all the secrecy? Jack Douglas said John thought maybe people didn't care anymore. Maybe, you know, he didn't have it anymore. You know, he was worried, not so much he didn't care, but that he didn't have it anymore and he would embarrass himself. He was very insecure, which is hard to believe, but you hit it. I mean, these people are human. We often forget about that.
What other music artists are favorites of yours to talk about and explore?
I kind of grew up in the 70s, so I was going back to all that stuff that everybody else likes, like the Beatles, Stones, Bob Dylan, the Kinks, the Doors, all that, you know, and kind of discovering that in the 70s. At the same time, I was a big fan of Springsteen and punk and new wave, like Elvis Costello. By the way, John Lennon was a fan of his song, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, a song Nick Lowe wrote. So, you know, kind of all that basic rock and roll. It's funny, as I've gotten older, I've kind of gone back further, back to the 50s and then back to the 40s and, you know, discovering jazz. And there's just so much out there. There's so much great music. I try to be open-minded and curious about it, no matter what the genre of music, and let myself listen to as many different styles as possible.
So you're just a fan of music?
Yeah, you could say that. Yep.
All right.
There's not too much I don't like.
Very good. Except opera?
I got to work on that. Yeah, I'm not quite there yet.
Okay.
Rock operas.
Tim, thank you so much for your time. It's been fun talking.
Same here, Lillian. Thank you.
To learn more about Tim English, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles and click on Today's Show. Okay, so here's where I need your help. Are you a Broadway fan? I sure am. And the theater is one of the things I'm missing most living in this pandemic. So I want to bring a little Broadway to an upcoming show on Lifestyles. Share a favorite Broadway musical, why it's a favorite of yours, and one of the songs you like from it. I may share your response on a future episode of Lifestyles. Come on, share a favorite Broadway musical with me at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. That's our show for this week. To hear any of our past shows, visit our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. You can also listen to Lifestyles on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play Music. Search for Lifestyles with Lillian Vasquez on your streaming service and take the show on the go. Thanks to all who helped to make this show possible, including Sharina Wad, David Fleming, Sean Houlihan, Andrew Caravella, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Our theme music is provided by Ethan Bortnick. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.